this way.
Good morning, all. My name is Ole Thompson, Bristol Comps Institute, University of Bristol. It's a pleasure for me to be chairing this session one. We have an exciting session in front of us. We have four oral presentations, and we have also videos for four posters. Let me just remind everybody about, and especially the speakers, of course, about the format here. So we have a 20-minute slot for an oral presentation and for a four-minute video. The oral presentation should conclude after 12 minutes, and then there'll be 4 minutes for questions, and then four for the video presentation. We will also have the possibility for online attendees to ask questions, so I shall try to manage that by cue from the people over here. So with no further ado, let me introduce you to the first speaker, and this is a paper called Determinant Fracture Properties for Predicting Damage Propagation from Notches in Composite Structures. It will be presented by a colleague from back home, Michael Wisnum. Michael.
Thank you very much. So this topic of this presentation is about using fracture mechanics and determining properties to predict failure of notch structures. And I'd like to acknowledge my collaborator, Xiaodong Xu, and our joint PhD student, Xiaoyong Sun, who contributed to this work. So the question really is about how can fracture mechanics be used to predict failure of large-scale notch structures. Composites exhibit very complex damage. You don't really have generally sharp cracks. Can linear elastic fracture mechanics still be applied? So in work we've done on large structures, we found that FE analysis using linear fracture mechanics can actually give useful results. But one of the key questions is, what translaminar fracture properties do you use in the models? So I'm going to talk about translaminar fracture toughness, whether it's a material or a laminate property. Should we be using single values, or do we need to consider the R curve? And I'll talk briefly about how we measure the properties. So if you try to do a translaminar fracture test on a UD material, then the material just splits. See if this thing works. There's a bit of a time delay here. Okay, right. So if you have a specimen with fibers in this direction here, then when you load it, it will just crack. So you have to test a laminate. And you can back calculate a UD property from the laminate test, and many people do that. But actually, that splitting is very important, and it also happens in the laminates. That splitting and associated delamination affects the damage zone, which affects the fracture toughness. So as a result of that, the fracture toughness depends very strongly on the layout. So here's some results which were actually presented at a comp test in 2008, where we tested different quasi-isotropic laminates with a different ply block thickness. So here you see that the plies, this first one has just got single plies, this one has got double plies, and this one's got four plies. And you see there's a big increase in the measured laminate fracture toughness as you increase and you block the plies together. And then you also see the opposite trend in more recent work on very thin plies. When you have very thin plies, the fracture toughness decreases. And you see the result here, which plots the fracture toughness against the ply thickness, and it's a fairly linear relationship, with thinner plies having much lower fracture toughness. It's also been observed that quasi-isotropic typically have higher laminate fracture toughness than cross-ply, and again, this is linked to the larger degree of damage that you get at the notch. Looking at some of the micrographs from the x-rays from these tests which I showed before, for the initial case with just single plies, then there's very little damage visible at the notch at this scale, but as you go to thicker plies, you get larger splitting and delamination zones occurring. And the GC also depends on the absolute laminate thickness as well. We found that thinner laminates tend to have slightly higher fracture toughness than thicker ones, even with the same ply block thickness and the same stacking sequence. So from all of this, I would argue that we cannot consider fracture toughness to be a ply property. We have to really consider it as a laminate property. So the next question really is can we get away with a single value, or do we need to consider the resistance curve? And there's very conflicting data if you look at different publications. So here I'm showing two different lots of results. This one here shows a very flat response with very little R-curve, but this recent work from our work on quasi-isotropics shows a very strong increase with crack increment and a very significant R-curve. Why is that? Well, there's several factors which influence that. The first thing is that this one here is a cross-ply laminate here, whereas this one is a quasi-isotropic. And quasi-isotropic laminates show a much greater resistance curve effect than do cross-ply, even with the same material here. And that's because we get a growth of a much larger and more complex damage zone with these quasi-isotropic laminates. We also see that the ply thickness affects not just the fracture toughness, but also the R-curve. So these results here are for quasi-isotropic laminates, and the top one was the one with the standard ply thickness of 0.125 millimeters with an overheight compact tension test, and we see this strong R curve associated with a very large damage zone at the notch. On the other hand, we've done these tests on thin ply with 0.03 millimeter ply thickness with also a quasi-isotropic stacking sequence, but this time many more repeated ply sublaminates. And you see a very flat response here, very little R-curve effect, much lower value, and also a very sharp crack. This really does look like a crack, almost like a metal, compared to this very diffuse damage zone we see with the thicker plies. So there seems to be this link that the ply thickness affects not just the initiation fracture toughness, but also the amount of resistance that we get. So what about measuring R-curves? Well, there could be a whole talk on this. It's a very complex subject, so I'll just touch on a few things. We use these overheight compact tension specimens, which were developed at the University of British Columbia, because that reduces the risk of getting a compressive failure at the top of the specimen. And to look at the effect of the size of those specimens, we did some scale tests where we took all the different parameters, everything is scaled there except in the thickness direction. The thickness are all the same, same laminate, same thickness, but the in-plane dimensions are all scaled. And what we see is that we get in the smaller specimens, we get a bit of an R curve. When we go to a bigger specimen, we can go a bit further. And when we go to the bigger specimens, we can go even further, but it's still following that increasing fracture toughness with size, and we've not yet reached a plateau. Even those bigger specimens are really too small. And another problem really with getting these large specimens is that the risk of buckling and compressive failure becomes more difficult as well. So I think there's some really difficult issues with testing fracture toughness, and we need to develop some better methods. There are also some questions about the validity of the data reduction methods. And one of the issues is that if the crack is long compared with the ligament size, we may get some spurious results. Now, this is a topic which really needs some further research, I think. It's not really very well understood. The ASTM standard includes an equation for the valid length. And when we did some tests, this is now on a different material, using some different types of specimens, we had this small ESET specimen here, which we had this result down here, and they continue to increase. But these results here were invalid according to the ASTM criterion, so we removed them. And then we'd had a bigger specimen, which was a CT specimen here, where we got quite a different response here, but again, these values up here were invalid. So there's a bit of a question mark about the range of validity of the data reduction. And if you took this one here, then if we took all those points, we'd see, well, it's a linearly increasing R curve, but actually, from bigger specimens, we see that it does start to plateau. So there's a real issue about interpreting the results from the tests and I think we need to have a better understanding of the data reduction techniques and the limits of their validity. So another interesting question is, what is the crack length? Given that we have generally a diffuse damage zone, it's not quite so clear how we should actually define the crack length, because we have this complex damage, and it's not, except in the case of very thin plies, it's not really sharp crack. So some very nice work that Jardon did some years ago with interrupted tests and CT micrography showed that the sequence of failure in a quasi-isotropic is that the zero plies fail first, but we have still have bridging 45 plies intact, and then at a later point, those the 45-degree plies fail as well. And we would argue that a crack, if you want to call it a crack, occurs really when all the plies are broken. So this diagram here shows that what we have is we have a zone where we have just the zeros broken, and this, we would argue, is really a damaged process zone, but not a crack. And then this, so the zeros are broken right up to here, and the 45s are only broken here. So we'd argue that this is the crack length up to about here, where all the plies are broken, and then you've got an effective crack length, which includes the effect of the process zone, which is a little bit longer. So this is quite important in interpreting the fracture toughness results and in using them to predict failure. And to demonstrate that, I'll show you some results from different specimens which we analysed, one of which was a small compact tension test. We have two specimens which have got their centre notch tension with actually bonded stringer fit at the end and with 17 and 70 millimetre notch. And then this panel here, which is a three-stringer panel with a 200-millimeter notch. So what are shown on the right here is finite element plots of the G, the energy release rate, at the experimental damage initiation loads. And that was determined by strain gauges very near the notch tip. And if you plot the energy release rate, then it increases with crack length, and applying simple analysis, we might expect to get similar values at the start here, but you can see they're actually quite different. So there's no consistency between these different results with the energy release rate at the different crack lengths for different specimens. So we then replotted that, and we plotted the G at the initial damage propagation load. So this was determined by gauges, strain gauges 5 millimeters from the notch tip, and when those gauges fail, that's because you've actually got a crack starting to propagate rather than just development of a damaged process zone. And when you plot the G at the loads where that damage was propagating, then you see that the curves all now coalesce, and we get the same value of G at this value of 3 millimeters effective crack length. And that 3 millimeters actually corresponds to the damage zone size that we see in the composite, which we could see by looking at the X-rays. So you can see here X-rays taken just after the peak load, and that round circle is 3 millimeters, and it encaptures that damage zone. So including the process zone in both the effective crack length and the G calculation gives consistent results for all four specimen sizes and allows that fracture toughness to be used to predict notch strength. So in conclusion, I would argue that translaminar fracture toughness should be considered to be a laminate, not a ply property. It depends on the layup, on the ply thickness particularly, and also on the absolute thickness. The R curves also depend strongly on the layup, and we tend to see greater R curves for quasi-isotropic and thick plies. We need very large specimens to measure that full R curve, and we need some more work to improve the test methods. But if we use that process zone in the crack length definition and the G calculation, we can get consistent results, which does enable effective use of linear fracture mechanics to predict structural response. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Michael, for that very interesting talk. We have time for a couple of questions. We're a bit overdue. Questions for the presentation?
Hello, Professor Winsome. First, thank you for this very nice presentation. And so my question is, during your presentation, you mentioned that there's some issues with the data reduction methods and precisely of the energy release rate depending on age, so the limitation of the validity of these data reduction methods. Wouldn't it be helpful to use testing configurations which have J-integral solutions where the J-integral fracture resistance it does not depend on A, such as DCV UVM, for instance? In this case, you don't have these problems with the crack length.
So I think J-integral is an interesting method, and there have been a few papers which have looked at the J-integral and compared it, and there's pluses and minuses. We have tried to use the J-integral method, and we found some discrepancies. So I'm not really sure of the answer to that question. I think it's still a bit of an open question, how best to measure this, and I think it needs some more research.
Thank you.
One more question.
I'm sorry. Hi, Michael. Only one question. This process zone, which is critical for these consistent results to be obtained, how can you evaluate it? Do you need to make the test, or can you predict, or it's a universal value for a determined?
So we have tried to do that. We did publish a paper where we used a high fidelity FE analysis, which was able to predict both the process zone and the initial part of the R curve. It's quite challenging computationally, but I think it's possible. But at the end of the day, I think you need to do some experiments at some level, at least to make sure that you've got a good experimental result.
Thank you very much, Michael.